Hello and welcome to the Veeam Community Podcast. I'm your host, Rick Vanover, and this is episode 21, Hyper-V Networking, Explain It To Me. Here we go. Today, our guest is Femi Adegoke. How you doing, Femi?
I'm fine, Rick. How are you?
Hey, I'm doing well. Thank you so much for being on the podcast today. I have to, before we get started, I have to tell everybody that Femi's been a very patient person within the social media space. Femi, and on Twitter, him and I have interacted quite a bit over the last few months, and Femi's on Twitter at Audio, that's spelled A-W-E-D-I-O, and he was constantly asking me, hey, when's Hyper-V support coming? When, you know, where's your answer? You have this blog post from 2009, but I don't have anything. And I got to say, you've been a very patient guy. I appreciate that.
Thank you.
And basically, I had said, I don't know, go follow this guy on Facebook. And when I said on Facebook, I was pointing to the Hyper-V Bear alias that VM Doug and I have been entertaining a limited number of people with thus far. So I appreciate that.
Hey, Rick. Yeah. Rick, I still don't like that Hyper-V Bear guy. He won't take my calls. So.
No, he's a one-way traffic-only type of guy. I'll agree with you there. The funny thing is, it actually is a stuffed – we have two of them, with two little stuffed bears, and we have the sinister cousin or evil twin or whatever, which has like a goatee, mustache or whatever. But, yeah, Doug and I have a little bit too much fun with that thing. I'll agree to that.
Fun with that.
So, Femi, take a moment and just kind of tell everybody about yourself and where you're from and all that good stuff.
All right. Like you said, name is Femi. Work for a company in Southern California called West Gastroenterology. We're in the healthcare space. And right now we're in the middle of an implementation, all Hyper-V. It's going to be, when it's all said and done, it's probably going to be about a 12-node cluster, Hyper-V, with all Dell hardware primarily on the front end, with some Dell Equalogic storage and some Dell MD series storage boxes. We are going to do VDI completely, 100%, with Windows 7, of course. We also have a couple of third-party apps, or I should say applications, that we're going to run with this VDI stack. So hopefully maybe Veeam on the backup, and then Versto, which we'll talk about later at another date, to help us with some of those IOs that we need for VD.
That's cool. So you've got the full offering, Hyper-V servers, you're going VDI route, 12-host cluster. That's a pretty sizable size. I think that's, you know, the largest Hyper-V cluster I've ever kind of heard of, you know, like directly talking to someone. So that's pretty cool.
Yes. Very excited about it. Very excited.
And now, on the networking side, you mentioned some of the storage that you have. Is that storage fiber channel or iSCSI, FCOE, or what's your storage network?
No, the storage network is all SCSI, just over Ethernet. And what we've done is we've taken that storage network and we're going to make it, you know, dedicated. So it's going to be a private network just for the storage, and it's completely separated from our LAN traffic.
Right, right. That's, you know, and in the VMware world and even just Windows iSCSI, you always want to put, you know, that storage protocol traffic on a different are you separating it at the switch level, like a fully separate network switch, or are you just trunking it out on a separate VLAN but on the same physical switch infrastructure as the rest of the networking?
Well, we have a few switches that we've stacked together. And then with that stack, the storage portion is just is really on its own VLAN.
Okay, cool, cool. Yeah, I mean, depending on who you ask, okay, the separation, at least, you know, in my experience, the VLAN separation is definitely the most common, and a lot of people call good enough, okay, but the storage purists and the security purists, of course, say, you know, it needs to be on a separate switch infrastructure and all that. But, you know, there's a lot of factors that go into defining the requirements and what really makes situations like that, you know, possible, you know, size, cost, and, you know, compliance and all those different things that I don't want to talk about today, but I get the point, for what you're doing. Now, how about, you know, your guest networking, you know, kind of thinking into where you're going with your environment and then where you are currently with the environment. How do you provision, what kind of networking do you do for the individual Hyper-V VMs right now?
Well, primarily, as you know, with Hyper-V, one of the things that we like to do or that we can do in Hyper-V is when you go into, again, this is, we're talking Hyper-V Manager. You go into the Hyper-V Manager, there's a setting there where you can go into the Virtual Network Manager, and there's three types of networks, external, internal, and private. External being ones that connect you to your physical network, like your LAN. Internal is communication between the VMs and the host, and then private is strictly VM-to-VM communication. And so external, you can go in there, and when you add an external network, you're able to see the physical NICs that are on the host. And then you have the option of either letting the host use a portion of that network, in other words, sharing it with the VMs, or you can dedicate it strictly to the virtual machines.
Gotcha.
So ideally, best practice, you should have multiple NICs and let the host, for management purposes, have the use of one NIC exclusively, and then whatever is left, you can share between your VMs.
Now, when you do that external connection that you share between your VMs, how do VLANs come into play? Is it just that option down there on the bottom, or is there anything more complicated to it?
No, so that's just like you said. So when you go in there and you say add external network, there's a drop-down box. You can see your physical NICs, so you choose whichever one you want. And then there's another checkbox where you can say enable VLAN. And then once you check that box, another box opens up and you can put your VLAN ID.
Gotcha. And that's an important – yeah, you got to make sure, though, you don't want to stack your management traffic on that same external connection, right? I've broken that and, you know, kind of orphaned my hosts a number of times. Is that right?
Correct. And you know, and like you and I, Rick, we'll have, you know, maybe a test dev lab. You know, if you've got a laptop, obviously in the laptop you'd only have one NIC. So in cases like that where you're just doing tests or demos, obviously you'd only have one NIC. So everything would be running over that one NIC. But obviously in a production setting, you would want to keep that traffic completely separate. Have your VMs on the LAN completely separate from the one NIC that you've dedicated to managing the host.
So that, you know, that design principle, okay, and I'll admit historically I'm a VMware guy, that's pretty straightforward. You know, separate those roles as much as possible. Can you, in that external connection, can you allocate multiple VLANs? Okay, in VMware they call it a virtual switch, but can you like stack up a couple of different VLANs on that? Like suppose you have a pair, say two network interfaces on the Hyper-V host that are connected to one or more physical switches that have one or more VLANs on them. Can you say, you know, VLAN 5, VLAN 10, VLAN 15 are all available from that quote-unquote team of two interfaces?
Yes. So you can go in, like I said, on that drop-down box, let's say you pick NIC number one, mm-hmm. and you can assign it. You can assign it that one VLAN, like VLAN 100, and then you'd apply and take that setting. Then you would add another external network, you know, pick the same one, mm-hmm. and then give it another VLAN number, you know, another VLAN ID.
Gotcha.
And once you do that, all those VLANs or virtual NICs, as they are now are, would be available for you to assign to your different VMs as you create those VMs.
And that makes perfect sense to me. The problem is, like, you know, and I said in the last episode, at least my Hyper-V experience has been somewhat limited to, like, academic, you know what I mean, where lab and, you know, home lab configuration. And I don't have VLANs available there. maybe I should work on that. But, you know, you're making it sound easy. I guess the number one thing, of course, is to keep that management traffic on a separate interface so that you don't effectively orphan, you know, your Hyper-V manager connection. Is that a fair statement?
That's a fair statement. But, you know, like we mentioned previously, sometimes when people are trying to get their feet wet with Hyper-V and they only have maybe a limited, you know, maybe a desktop that they converted to a server, or they've got a laptop, in those kinds of cases, you know, you really don't have choice. So everything runs over the same NIC. But if you've got a better, or if you're going out, maybe you're going to go buy a new server, that's one of the big things we always try to preach is, try to buy those extra NIC cards. I know they're expensive, you know, like an Intel quad port NIC is usually $400 to $500, but it's definitely money well spent if you're doing something like this.
Yeah, because really there's at least three categories. There's your management traffic, your storage traffic, and your guest VM traffic, and that can easily put you at just getting started with six interfaces, for any redundancy for any type of production. I can't really see it being less than that.
Correct. So, that is correct, yes.
What do you, Hyper-V Manager, here's my observation, because I've mentioned I've had it running in my lab. I had SCVMM running in my lab. I found Hyper-V Manager is very straightforward, very simple to use for, you know, managing the Hyper-V host, but SCVMM, of course, is a little bit more complicated of a beast. Do you do both, or do you only do Hyper-V Manager?
I do both, but obviously when I first started, I started with Hyper-V Manager. And it, like you said, it's pretty simple, pretty easy to use. And it's one of the things when people ask me about Hyper-V that I try to tell them is, you know, just start with Hyper-V Manager.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's you know, just go in there, play around with stuff. You can't really break it. I mean, well, you can break stuff, but
I'll break it. I can do it.
You know, but just go in there. You can do a lot of things that you can do from SCVMM. You can still do in Hyper-V Manager, and then once you get comfortable with that, then by all means, you know, graduate or move up or whatever the term is, and then start using SCVMM. But for people that want to just kind of get their feet wet, learn about Hyper-V, it's a very good place to start, because you can see all those settings that we've just been talking about, the network, you know, NIC cards and the VLANs, they're all there, and you can use them there right in Hyper-V Manager.
And, you know, there's a couple of, caveats between the two tools. I mean, fully, you know, they can both do about the same thing, but there's also, I've noticed, a couple of weird differences between them. For example, you get familiar with the two interfaces, and you'll find that Hyper-V Manager calls a virtual machine snapshot a snapshot, and SCVMM calls a virtual machine snapshot a checkpoint. But yet, they're really the same thing. There's an intricate little difference between the definitions if you look them up on TechNet. I'll spare people the boredom of that, but generally, you know, that's one example where one interface provides a slightly different look and feel to the same thing.
That is correct, and one of the mistakes I still even make from time to time is when I'm in a hurry, right, sometimes I'll just go into Hyper-V Manager, when I think ideally, once you start using SCVMM, really you want to try to go there and do most of your management in that console.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're not, you know, they don't follow each other kind of lock and step.
Exactly. And they, and I've also found that if you do some things on Hyper-V Manager directly, it may not display in SCVMM, at least not initially.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So ideally you'd like to just stay with one, and once you get SCVMM, just stay in there and do as much as you can in that console.
Okay, well that's kind of really good advice, you know, especially on the networking side, because like I said, at least I've goofed up a host a number of times. What kind of advice can you you know, offer if somebody wants to get started with Hyper-V? You mentioned about making sure we have plenty of network interfaces. What other kind of gotchas, you know, be it in lab or test dev, what type of other gotchas might you throw out there if anybody's thinking about starting up a Hyper-V lab?
So in addition to the one you just mentioned, which is the big one, which is NIC cards or NICs, and by the way, one other trick that I think I read on the internet somewhere or on the blogs for people that have laptops is you can actually buy a USB to NIC, it's a USB to, I guess, TCP/IP converter.
Oh, like an Ethernet attached USB adapter?
Yes.
Or actually USB attached Ethernet adapter?
Which, yes.
That's what it is. Yeah, okay, got it.
And the good thing is they even have them now where they're gigabit. So for when you're doing your test dev stuff on the laptop, if you want to add one or two more NIC cards, that's one way to do it.
Uh-huh.
On the laptop, of course. Or even on the desktop. If you've got like a tower or desktop style machine mm-hmm. that only has one NIC card, usually they always have, you know, four or more USB ports.
Mm-hmm.
So you can, and those things are cheap. They're about $30 a piece. So that's one good way to, increase your NIC count mm-hmm. on machines that are limited. The other big one is memory. So I think these days memory has gotten pretty cheap to where you should be able to, I think on a desktop it's pretty easy to get up to 8 gigs of memory, you know, 16.
Mm-hmm.
16 would be nice. And that way you can just build VMs and not have to worry about running out of memory.
Yeah, and there's one thing we know we ought to all kind of throw out there just so we know, and that's, you know, Hyper-V's memory management is different than, you know, what the VMware crowd is used to. You know, tell us a little bit about what you've done with, you know, memory management on guest VMs and, you know, what you've learned along the way.
Well, the good thing is for people that are starting or want to start getting their feet wet today, with 2008 R2 SP1, this is like Christmas now. Because in the past, let's say you had a machine that was limited to, let's just say, 4 gigs of memory, and you had a couple of VMs, and you allocated some memory to the VMs, okay? Right away, those VMs took charge of that memory, regardless of the fact whether they needed it or not. And so today now with dynamic memory, obviously in SP1,
mm-hmm.
you can go in there and you got a minimum and a maximum amount of memory. So you can start a Windows 7 VM or a 2008 R2 VM and have it boot up at 512 megs of memory, which is fantastic. So now you can add more VMs, okay, because once the VM boots up, you can see how much memory the VM is using versus in the past where if you had allocated that same VM, say, two gigs, once you turned it on, it would take 2 gigs. And once you ran out of memory, you could not boot up any more VMs. So Service Pack 1 with dynamic memory has really, really helped, and will really help, you know, going forward, as far as VM density.
Yeah, and everybody, if you're not familiar with dynamic memory, I've poked around with the features, but I haven't been able. I guess I had it available, but I didn't configure it in my lab. But, you know, there's four big settings. There's startup RAM, maximum RAM, a memory buffer, and a memory weight. Check out there's this TechNet page called Hyper-V Dynamic Memory Configuration Guide. It's the first Google result for me, so that might be a good place to start if you're thinking about, you know, leveraging that. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't believe memory ever gets taken away until that VM is rebooted. Is that correct?
It's until the VM is booted up, and yes, that is correct. And
okay.
One thing that we should point out is it's really as easy as right-clicking on the VM, going to settings, and one of your options is memory.
Mm-hmm.
Now, to make the change, the VM has to be off. So this is not a change that you can make on the fly mm-hmm. once the VM is running.
Gotcha.
So once the VM is off, you can check the dynamic box, And like you mentioned, Rick, you can put the startup RAM in there, put maximum RAM, adjust the buffer, and adjust the priority, and say okay, turn it back on, and away you go.
Well, that brings up another good question that I've got. This feature, you know, as you're explaining, is not a hot add feature that you can just dynamically turn on for the VM. But I don't know, and that's why I'm asking. Can you hot add network interfaces? Because that was one thing in, you know, in VMware at least that I really liked to be able to do whenever I had to add another VM NIC to a guest. I could just do a hot add and, you know, detect it, configure it, and be on my way. Can we do that with Hyper-V?
Yes and no.
Ooh.
So in other words, if I go in VM, right-click on it, go to that same settings page that we just talked about, it has to be off for me to add those VM, those NICs that we had set up, whether it's an internal, private, or an external.
Mm-hmm.
It has to be off for you to add that. Now, once it's added, so in other words, I can add it, but I don't have to connect it.
Gotcha. Okay.
So as long as it's added, once the machine is on, then I can connect it to, you know, some VLAN or some network or whatever that you'd like to connect it to.
Mm-hmm.
But you can only add that network interface if the machine is off.
So you could do like a hot connect, meaning it's inventoried on the guest VM, it's visible in the guest OS, but it's linked down, if you will. But and then you
correct.
You could configure it to be link up in a specified external network, but you could not on a running VM add a new virtual network interface that would be inventoried and then configured. So it's not quite hot add, but it would be hot connect, if you will.
Hot connect. Yeah, that's a good one.
I'm making these terms up as we go, so you can see where I am with Hyper-V. All right, well, that's cool, man. Well, say, what kind of other, you know, like I said, you have kind of like the best, you know, of the, you know, short list of people I know with Hyper-V. You've got like the biggest environment, you know, potential going on. You mentioned VDI coming down the way, 12 host cluster, it's all good stuff. But, you know, backtrack a little bit. How did you end up wanting to be in Hyper-V? You know, what kind of decision factors pointed you that way, you know, from the start?
Well, a little bit of my background. I came to the IT by way of audio, which is kind of how my Twitter handle is. That's where it came from. Is I used to be a guy in the car audio business. And then I did some home theater and some home audio. And then I just loved, you know, the computers and the virtual machines. And then I kind of, I guess, mistakenly found my way into the IT world. And I guess, and one of the things that I loved earlier on, and I think, Rick, you had mentioned this in one of your previous podcasts, was you had mentioned something about you were doing, you had a one-to-one ratio where you were converting, I think, some VMs, some physical machines to VMs. And the ratio wasn't great, but it was one-to-one for whatever reason. And I think that is really speaks to one of the things I love about virtualization is the flexibility and the portability of what you can do with this technology.
Sure.
Okay. And so originally, I think a couple of years ago, I started with Virtual Iron. And I really love this product because it let you do things like, I called it the poor man's VMware. Because you were able to do, I forget what they called, they had a term for their live migration or vMotion.
Mm-hmm.
They had their own term for it, but you could do it without clustering.
Look out.
And it all came with the... What?
Look out. That's crazy. Without
yes.
a cluster.
Without a cluster. But, of course, you know, Oracle bought that company, and, well, the rest of that story is history. So that led me to Hyper-V, and really I started playing with it. That was back in, like, I think late 2006, 2007. And it's very interesting to see... All the third-party products that are now starting to come up in the market for Hyper-V.
Definitely. Yeah. Cheap plug commence. And, you know, if you didn't catch it last week, Veeam announced that our version 6 of backup and replication will include Hyper-V support, which, again, is how Femi and I got talking. So you're right. You're seeing the ecosystem catch up. End of cheap plug.
Yep.
Okay. So, hey, that's a great story, man, because simply, you know, we all end up in certain technology situations for a number of different reasons. And that kind of leads me to the next part of the podcast here, which is my quote-unquote gimmick. And that's the three views from you series of questions that I'd like to ask you. And since this is your first time on the podcast, you are in the hot seat. So Femi, as a technologist, and it doesn't have to be, you know, technology that we know of in virtualization, just, you know, we all like gadgets, we all like electronics and all that. What's the most interesting technical story or role or experience you have sometime in your past that you could share with us?
And it doesn't have to be about virtualization, right?
No, whatever's interesting. Could be, you know, because you mentioned the audio background, you might have a good story to tell.
Well, one of the things I like to do in my spare time, Rick, is I like to machine. So I've got in my garage, I own a machining center, a vertical machining center.
Cool.
It's a Herco. It's got a 15,000 RPM spindle on it. And I like to play around with SolidWorks. So I design some parts, make some parts of my car, go out there, and I machine them. So a couple of years ago, this was like in 2003, I built this car. And I've always I love cars, I love but a couple of things that I loved are air jacks on Formula One cars and those center lock wheels. So I built this car, and I machined these air jacks, and I machined these wheels, so there were this car had center lock wheels, and it had air jacks. And I thought, man, this is one of the coolest things I had ever done.
That's wicked. You made the whole car, or did you, like, take a frame and just totally...
No. The car was a Volkswagen Passat. Uh-huh. It had a big turbo kit on there. It was a 1.8 liter engine with the turbo. So put these big brakes on there, modified this thing, welded these air jacks on, and used to take it all to all these shows around here.
Man, that's pretty cool.
I'll have to put that on my blog one of these days.
Yeah, Femi's just launching his blog. I'm going to put the blog notes in the URL in the podcast. But yeah, definitely blog picture material, man. That's awesome. How about right now? What's going on today? You know, technology wise, is most interesting to you right now?
Well, two things, Rick, and I think the first one was kind of how you and I connected, which was over Twitter or, you know, the social media side of things, where really it's amazing that today's world, I mean, you get to reach out to so many people, and not just reaching out, but you can actually get some very, very useful help and information from people that are, you know, halfway across the world, on the other side of the world, you know, different time zones. It doesn't really matter. So really, you know, that saying where they say the world is really a small place, mm-hmm. I think for me is really big, because the ability to share information and just pass things back and forth with people that hopefully you'll get to meet face-to-face at some point in time, I think is really huge. And the second thing for me, I think, is the implementation that we're working on right now at work, which is Hyper-V and Versto, where we're going to do VDI with Hyper-V on the back end, Windows 7 virtual machines, and I really think I'm really looking forward to getting this thing off the ground.
Cool. How about into the future, longer term technology-wise, you know, what is most interesting to you, you know, down the road?
I think that this whole concept that we're starting to see a lot of it, where the ability for anybody, for the little man or little woman, to be able to have a highly available environment. Because last year, I think, was my first time of trying clustering. Never done it before.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And the ability to be able to do it, and really it's almost the next kind of deal. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's that simple. And, you know, you run through that whole checklist, you know, and Microsoft has automated that whole thing for us. And it's amazing that, you know, with a minimum of like three servers, any small business or even, you know, one, two-man business can have highly available applications and a highly available setup. I mean, to me, it's almost mind-boggling.
That's true, because, you know, you step back even 5-10 years, that was reserved for enterprise IT, you know, availability and, you know, business continuity, you know, even for the smallest business, you know, you're really limited to, you know, a couple of PCs, a server, maybe a backup tape, right? And throw all that out the window now, right? So, yeah, that's a good observation. I think definitely these features are definitely made available to anyone who's willing to try new technology, simply put. That's awesome.
Well, and the other thing also, Rick, is then you start looking at the ecosystem like you talked about. You know, got VM for backup now. I mean, you've got all these things really that are coming in that so you know, now you're done clustering. Now you've got these applications running. You know, it's like, how do I take care of my backup or monitoring or you know, SAN storage? Mm-hmm. So there's so many options now, from the free, you know, like Microsoft has the new iSCSI Target software. Mm-hmm. That's free.
Yep.
A company like Starwind, they have a free version. Mm-hmm. But now you can take their free version and upgrade when you're done to a production version. So really, when you combine that with things like Veeam, I mean, you got it all made.
Yeah, definitely the, you know, I like to call it the freemium model, where, you know, you lead with the free tools, right, that give a certain amount of functionality and that, you know, paves the way to, you know, oh, I like it, and then let's roll it into production because that's what I know. I mean, there's no trick. I mean, big companies, little companies are doing that, and it's proving successful. Well, hey, Femi, let's wrap it up here. First of all, I really thank you for taking the time to be on the show here. This has been a great discussion. Again, he's on Twitter at Audio, and that's spelled AWEDIO. And I'm going to put his blog, which isn't quite ready, kind of still secret and underground. It's got some content on it, but we'll put that in the podcast notes. If anybody has any questions on the podcast, you can send an email to podcast@veeam.com. You can follow me on Twitter at Rick Vanover, as well as follow the Veeam Twitter feed at Veeam. Femi, hey, thanks again for being on.
Rick, thank you very much, man. It was a pleasure talking with you.
All right. Cheers.